Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Here's the plan. Every year, right around mid-December, we usually suspend our midweek services until after the first of the year. And we've done that for the last several years. And if I just read tonight, nonstop, without comment, at a rapid pace, we could finish the book of Exodus. Yeah, it's really only three more chapters, but there is some stuff that needs to be talked about. I'm getting the wrap it up sign from the back of the room. So here's what I'm proposing. We might finish it tonight, and then we'll come back after the first of the year. I'll give you plenty of warning on what the date is. And that way, too, we're not starting a new book and then taking our Christmas break. So let's finish the book of Exodus. If we happen to finish it tonight, then that's it for this year. 2008 is closed. Well, and it is so much just straightforward technical information, we should be able to read it out. So there's a possibility we could just get done tonight. Now, what I'd like to do after the first of the year is that I would like to continue the first five books of the Bible. I'd like to go on into Leviticus. However, I'm probably going to change the format a bit. I don't know how many of you have ever taken a survey class in college, but what survey basically means, especially in Bible parlance, is that rather than going verse by verse in all the minutiae and detail that we typically do when we go through a book, a survey allows that sometimes we're just going to summarize. Because the first couple of chapters, for instance, of the book of Leviticus are all the detailed information about how to prepare various sacrifices. And the information is largely the same over and over with just small differences. And so that's the kind of stuff that we really can survey and then stop and look at the details in the chapters that actually require closer examination. So it would be more like a survey of Leviticus, survey of Numbers, survey of Deuteronomy, because I don't really want to stop right at the end of the book of Exodus, the same way I didn't want to stop right at the end of the book of Genesis, because this is all part of Moses' account of the early establishment of Israel, and there's still a whole lot to say. At the end of the book of Exodus, we haven't even reached Israel leaving Mount Sinai. We haven't gotten to the edge of the promised land. We haven't talked about Israel sending spies into the promised land and then their 40-year journey. There's so much more to know about the history of Israel and God's promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that we can't stop at the end of the book of Exodus, because that's not really where Moses stopped. He just continued, and it's broken out into these various books. So we're going to keep going, but we'll change the format a bit, and that way nobody has to worry about the longer, more difficult sections like all the begatting in the book of Numbers. There's a lot of names in there I can't pronounce. But if I can survey those chapters and tell you where the important bits of genealogy are, then that'll make it much easier. So, chapter 38, correct, Tom?
Yes.
Okay, chapter 38 of Exodus is where we're going to start tonight. What really jumps out at this moment, this will be my introductory comment. I'll try to keep it to 5 minutes, and then we'll just try to read it out and finish the book tonight. But what really jumps out at this moment is, as I just mentioned, Israel is on their way to the promised land. But as we're going to find out tonight, the tabernacle is going to be constructed. The work is going to be finished and the tabernacle put up on the first day of the second year of their journey, which means all this time since leaving Egypt, they've come out into the desert, They got to Mount Sinai, and they've been there ever since. Of course, there were those two 40-day periods where Moses was up on the mountain with God while Israel was at the foot of the mountain. But all this time since their departure, they're just cooling their heels there at the foot of Mount Sinai. So you have to think about how much time has elapsed while God just tells them what the rules are. He's going to take them to the edge of the promised land because he told Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that he would. But before he even shows them the promised land, before he even takes them to the foot of the land and says, it's right there, it's right over the Jordan, go get it. Before he even takes them to it, he stops them for a whole year while he talks about his rules, his laws, and his worship, and says, build me this tabernacle. Sure, you've got a homecoming, you've got a homeland, you've got a promise of a land that you're going to be settled in, but before I even take you to your land, I'm going to require, not request, I'm going to demand and require of you that you build a place for me so that I am preeminent in everything that I'm doing here with you. I've used this phrase many, many times, but throughout the Bible, you get a very consistent personality profile of what God is like. And as I kept saying on Sunday, God first, Jesus first, and in God and Jesus' own estimation, they have to be first. They have to be primary. Everything in your life centers around the worship of God first. And that's what he's showing Israel. He's brought them out of Egypt, delivered them with a mighty hand, but then he doesn't just make a beeline to the promised land and say, here it is, milk and honey, peace from all your enemies. I'm going to just take you to your land and give you all your rewards. Before he gives them any rewards, he takes them to Mount Sinai and says, now here's what I demand of you. And I'm going to take up an offering, and you're going to build a tabernacle. You're going to build a place that you're going to carry around on your shoulders. It's going to be a burden to you. And that burden is going to speak of my holiness, that I am separate from you, so holy, in fact, that you can't even come in to the tent. Once I've established it, once I have sanctified it, once my spirit has filled it, you can't even come in it anymore. And in the holiest place, only the high priest can come in, only once a year, only in the right clothes, only with the right sacrifice. I'm different than you. I'm God. He's establishing this among Israel. The place that speaks of atonement has to be established first. The place that speaks of sacrifice and substitution and scapegoat, that has to be established first. The place that talks of the covering, the kappareth, and the blood on the covering, that comes first. The place that has the law, the Ten Commandments, contained in a golden box, this comes first. And then once Israel learns proper worship and respect and fear for God, then he leads them toward their promise. But God puts himself first. That ought to tell us something. That ought to tell us that in God's estimation, God comes first, because it's real, real easy, real, real natural, real, real fleshly, and typical of humans to forget that in our day-to-day life. Do you think that there was any day in the 40 years of wandering in the desert, while their clothes weren't wearing out, while the leather of their sandals remained intact, while there was bread from heaven every day, while they had to carry the tent around and pitch the tent in the middle of their camp, do you think there was any day that Israel wasn't aware of the command of God on their lives? I mean, he's making himself just as big and plain and obvious as he can. And yet, they would rebel and argue and complain and say, I hate this light bread and I'm tired of the journey and you brought us out here to kill us. And look at how depraved humans are. Even with all this evidence right in their midst and God saying, me first, me first, me first, people go, no, me first. I want what I want and I want what I want when I want it. Me first. But God consistently teaches the same thing. He has to be primary in the life of his people. And I think that's what all this detail is about. As we read through these last three chapters and you see all the detail laid out, remember that every bit of this is exactly what God commanded. And in fact, when we get to the end of chapter 40, well, not even the end, chapter 40, verse 16, thus Moses did according to all that the Lord had commanded him, so he did. Everything that's happening here is exactly what God commanded of the children of Israel for the first year that they were camped at the bottom of this mountain. So God is making sure that they know he's primary. Have you got that point?
Yep.
Okay, now we can start reading. Chapter 38. Then he made the altar of burnt offering of acacia wood, 5 cubits long and 5 cubits wide, square, and 3 cubits high. And he made its horns on its 4 corners, its horns being of 1 piece with it, and he overlaid it with bronze. And he made all the utensils of the altar, the pails and the shovels and the basins, the flesh hooks and the fire pans, and he made all its utensils of bronze. And he made for the altar a grating of bronze network beneath, underneath its ledge, reaching halfway up. And he cast 4 rings on the 4 ends of the bronze grating as holders for the poles. And he made the poles of acacia wood and overlaid them with bronze. And he inserted the poles into the rings on the sides of the altar with which to carry it. He made it hollow with planks. Moreover, he made the laver of bronze with its base of bronze from the mirrors of the serving women who served at the doorway of the tent of meeting. Then he made the court. For the south side, the hangings of the court were of fine twisted linen, 100 cubits. Their 20 pillars and their 20 sockets made of bronze. The hooks of the pillars and their bands were of silver. And for the north side, there were 100 cubits. Their 20 pillars and their 20 sockets were of bronze, and the hooks of the pillars and their bands were of silver. And for the west side there were hangings of 50 cubits with their 10 pillars and 10 sockets. Their hooks of the pillars and their bands were of silver. And for the east side 50 cubits, the hangings for the one side of the gate were 15 cubits with their 3 pillars and their 3 sockets. And so for the other side. On both sides of the gate of the court were hangings of 15 cubits with their 3 pillars and their 3 sockets. All the hangings of the court all around were of fine twisted linen. And the sockets for the pillars were of bronze, the hooks of the pillars and their bands of silver, and their overlaying of their tops with silver, and all the pillars of the court were furnished with silver bands. And the screen of the gate of the court was the work of a weaver of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen. And the length was 20 cubits, and the height was 5 cubits, corresponding to the hangings of the court. And their 4 pillars and their 4 sockets were of bronze, their hooks were of silver, and the overlaying of the tops and their bands were of silver. And all the pegs of the tabernacle of the court all around were of bronze. Now, this is the number of the things for the tabernacle. The tabernacle of the testimony, as they were numbered, according to the command of Moses, for the service of the Levites by the hand of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest. Now, Bezalel, the son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, made all that the Lord had commanded Moses. And with him was Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan, an engraver, and a skillful workman, and a weaver in blue and in purple, and in scarlet material and fine linen. All the work that was used for the work, in all the work of the sanctuary, even the gold of the wave offerings, was 29 talents and 730 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. And the silver of those of the congregation who were numbered was 100 talents and 1,775 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary. a beka, a head, that is half a shekel, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, for each one who passed over to those who were numbered from 20 years old and upward, for 603,550 men. Now that's interesting. Because remember, I said I wasn't going to comment, but you got to see this. Because remember that they brought offerings until they were told to stop. And at the exact moment they were told to stop, it totaled half a shekel for every single man who passed through the Red Sea from 20 years and up. Wasn't that lucky? God just got so lucky that the half shekel offering happened to be exact to 603,550 men. So God got his half shekel offering from each man. Now, by the way, if there were 603,550 men, and we assume that the majority, being over 20, would have wives, and that many of them would have children, how many people are we talking about camped at the foot of Mount Sinai for a year while God takes Moses up there and gives them instructions?
2 to 5 million.
Yeah. Somewhere between 2 and 5 million, yeah, says... is your guess, and you said your note says over 5 million. Either way, it's a remarkable number. And God makes the whole company stop for a year after their miraculous deliverance while he sets up his place of worship.
It's a lot of people.
And the 100 talents of silver were for casting the sockets of the sanctuary and the sockets of the veil, 100 sockets for the 100 talents, a talent for a socket. And of the 1,775 shekels, he made hooks for the pillars and overlaid their tops and made bands for them. And the bronze of the wave offering was 70 talents and 2,400 shekels. And with it, he made the sockets to the doorway of the tent of meeting and the bronze altar and its bronze gratings and all the utensils of the altar. And the sockets of the court all around, and the sockets of the gate of the court, and all of the pegs of the tabernacle, and all the pegs of the court all around. Chapter 39. Moreover, from the blue and the purple and the scarlet material, they made finely woven garments for ministering in the holy place, as well as the holy garments which were for Aaron, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And he made the ephod of gold and of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen. And they hammered out gold sheets and cut them into threads to be woven in with the blue and the purple and the scarlet material and the fine linen, the work of a skillful workman. Can you imagine? These slaves out here in the wilderness know enough to make fine little sheets of gold to the point where you could cut them into thread work and then weave that thread together with all the fine material of the different colors so that when the high priest put on this outfit, he was beautiful, he was colorful, he shimmered with gold. And they made attaching shoulder pieces for the ephod. It was attached at its two upper ends. And the skillfully woven band which was on it was like its workmanship, of the same material, of gold and of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And they made the onyx stones set in gold filigree settings. They were engraved like the engraving of a signet according to the names of the sons of Israel. And he placed them on the shoulder pieces of the ephod, as memorial stones for the sons of Israel, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And he made the breastpiece, the work of a skillful workman, like the workmanship of the ephod, of gold and of blue and of purple and scarlet, material and fine twisted linen, and it was square. And they made the breastpiece folded double, a span long and a span wide when folded double. And they mounted four rows of stones on it. The first row was a row of ruby, topaz, and emerald. And the second row, a turquoise, a sapphire, and a diamond. And the third row, a jacinth, and an agate, and an amethyst. And the fourth row, a beryl, and an onyx, and a jasper. and they were set in gold filigree settings when they were mounted. And the stones were corresponding to the names of the sons of Israel. They were 12 corresponding to their names, engraved with the engraving of a signet, each with its name for the 12 tribes. And they made on the breastplate chains like cords of twisted cordage, work of pure gold. And they made 2 gold filigree settings and 2 gold rings, and put the 2 rings on the 2 ends of the breastpiece. And they put the 2 gold cords in the 2 rings at the ends of the breastpiece. And they put the other 2 ends of the 2 cords on the 2 filigree settings and put them on the shoulder pieces of the ephod at the front of it. And they made 2 gold rings and placed them on the 2 ends of the breastpiece on its inner edge, which was next to the ephod. Furthermore, they made the 2 gold rings and placed them on the bottom of the 2 shoulder pieces of the ephod, on the front of it, close to the place where it joined, above the woven band of the ephod. And they bound the breastpiece by its 2 rings to the rings of the ephod with a blue cord, that it might be on the woven band of the ephod, and that the breastpiece might not come loose from the ephod, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Then he made the robe of the ephod of woven work, all of blue, and the opening of the robe was at the top in the center, as the opening of a coat of mail, with its binding all around its opening, that it might not be torn. I have to pause for one short second, because I can't read by that. When are we ever going to be here again? Isn't it interesting that Moses took the time to detail the clothing that the high priest would wear, which I think is so that future generations would never get it wrong? This is how he must be dressed. This is what you've got to have on to go in there. He knows from God that it's really, really important that this be the clothing he's wearing. But why did Moses take the time to write that the robe he would wear would only have an opening for his head and that would be woven throughout? Remember what Jesus' robe was like?
Seamless.
Yeah, a seamless robe, which means it would have been made the same way. And that's why they ended up throwing dice for his robe, is that it was a valuable robe and shouldn't be ripped apart. If it had been sewn together, you'd just take apart the thread in between the pieces and you can have that nice material for other things. But this was woven throughout, so they ended up casting lots for his robe, and it's described exactly the way that the high priest's robe is described. What does that tell you about Jesus walking around on the planet?
He's our high priest.
Isn't that exactly what the writer of Hebrews says? And even his clothing spoke to it. So I just wanted to point that out so that the next time you see in the New Testament that Jesus wore a nice robe woven throughout, it's an expensive robe, that you understand why he wore that. He was represented as the high priest. Verse 24, and they made pomegranates of blue and purple and scarlet material and twisted linen on the hem of the robe. And they also made bells of pure gold and put the bells between the pomegranates all around on the hem of the robe, alternating a bell and a pomegranate all around the hem of the robe for the service, just as the Lord had commanded Moses, because you want to be able to hear those bells. Because if the bells stop, the priest is dead. Verse 27, and they made the tunics of finely woven linen for Aaron and his sons, and the turban of fine linen, and the decorated caps of fine linen, and the linen breeches of fine twisted linen, and the sash of fine twisted linen, and blue and purple and scarlet material, the work of a weaver, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And they made the plate of the holy crown of pure gold, and inscribed it with the engraving of a signet, holiness to the Lord. I've talked about that a lot in the past, but let's take one more second and talk about it because we're making pretty good time. I think it's really, really fascinating that when God looks down on the high priest, when the high priest comes in once a year with the atonement offering, I think it's really interesting that God would say, the foremost thought I want to see engraved on your forehead in pure gold is the phrase, holiness to the Lord. I know that I have argued time and time again that God's primary attribute, his primary characteristic, is his holiness. But here God demanded that the gold plate on the forehead of the high priest say, holiness to the Lord. Notice it does not say, God is love. It does say, holiness to the Lord. Now, in prophecy of the future kingdom under the new covenant, it says that every piece of pottery and the dishes and even the bells that are on the reins of the horses will be holiness to the Lord. There is a time coming when everything in God's kingdom is going to state holiness to the Lord. But at this moment, the intercessor between Israel and God has to have holiness to the Lord plastered on his forehead. Again, consistent personality profile. God is telling us what he's like, and he's primarily holy. Verse 31, and they fastened a blue cord to it to fasten it to the turban above, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Remember what blue stands for, signifies? Remember when we talked about the different colors of the tabernacle and how they tie to the four gospels and how they tie to the four living creatures? What does the blue signify?
Okay, blue means an eagle, a god, and according to John, yeah.
But what does it stand for in terms of a characteristic? Eternity. So it's interesting that God would even be specific and say, blue cord, use blue cord. Elizabeth went, oh. Yeah, it's right there in your notes.
Yeah.
So God is specific in saying, and that gold plate that speaks of my holiness, make sure it's bound in blue. I am eternally holy. God speaking over and over of his infinite holiness. We are in verse 32. Thus all the work of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting was completed. And the sons of Israel did according to all that the Lord had commanded Moses. So they did. And they brought the tabernacle to Moses, the tent, and all its furnishings, its clasps, its boards, its bars, and its pillars, and its sockets, and the covering of ram skins dyed red, and the covering of porpoise skins, and the screening veil, the ark of the testimony, and its poles, and the mercy seat, the table, all its utensils, and the bread of the presence, and the pure gold lampstand with its arrangement of lamps and all its utensils and the oil for the light and the gold altar and the anointing oil and the fragrant incense and the veil for the doorway of the tent, the bronze altar and its bronze grating, its poles and all its utensils, the laver and its stand, the hangings for the court, its pillars and its sockets, and the screen for the gate of the court, its cords and its pegs, and all the equipment for the service of the tabernacle for the tent of meeting, the woven garments for ministering in the holy place, and the holy garments for Aaron the priest, and the garments for his sons to minister as priests. So the sons of Israel did all the work according to all that the Lord had commanded Moses. And Moses examined all the work, and behold, they had done it. Just as the Lord had commanded, this they had done. So Moses blessed them. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, on the first day of the first month, you shall set up the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. And you shall place the ark of the testimony there. And you shall screen the ark with the veil. And from that point forward, by the way, the ark was then veiled off from everybody except the high priest. And it's remained veiled ever since. And you shall bring in the table and arrange what belongs on it. And you shall bring in the lampstand and mount its lamps. Moreover, you shall set the gold altar of incense before the ark of the testimony and set up the veil for the doorway to the tabernacle. And you shall set the altar of burnt offering in front of the doorway of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. Just so you understand what's happening here, I don't know if you can visualize it in your mind, but what he said was first take the Ark of the Covenant and put it in the holiest place. It starts there. Start at the place where God and man will meet. then close that off with the veil, so that from that point forward the ark is separated and veiled. Then they work out from there, set up the lampstand, set up the altar in the outer courts, and then out from there set up the laver of cleansing. So what Moses is being told to do, once all the stuff's been brought to him, is to build the tabernacle, and with each piece, he starts with the holiest piece, or the most separate piece, and then he builds out from there. So try to picture all this in your mind, if you can. In my mind, if we had done this next week, I was going to show off my artistic acumen and draw this on the board as we went, but I will forego that. Moreover, you will set the gold altar of incense before the Ark of the Testimony and set up the veil for the doorway of the tabernacle, or to the tabernacle. Verse 6, and you shall set the altar of burnt offering in front of the doorway of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. And you shall set the laver between the tent of meeting and the altar to put water in it. And you shall set up the court all around and hang up the veil for the gateway of the court. Then you shall take the anointing oil and anoint the tabernacle and all that is in it. And you shall consecrate it and all its furnishings, and it shall be holy. And you shall anoint the altar of burnt offering and all its utensils, and consecrate the altar, and the altar shall be most holy. And you shall anoint the laver and its stand and consecrate it. Then you shall bring Aaron and his sons to the doorway of the tent of meeting and wash them with water. And you shall put the holy garments on Aaron and anoint him and consecrate him that he may minister as a priest to me. And you shall bring his sons and put tunics on them. And you shall anoint them even as you have anointed their father, that they may minister as priests to me. And their anointing shall qualify them for a perpetual priesthood throughout their generations. And thus Moses did according to all that the Lord had commanded him, so he did. Verse 17. Now it came about in the first month of the second year, on the first day of the month, that the tabernacle was erected. And Moses erected the tabernacle and laid its sockets and set up its boards and inserted its bars and erected its pillars. And he spread the tent over the tabernacle and put the covering of the tent on top of it, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Then he took the testimony, which is the tablets of stone, the second set of stones that he brought down. He took the testimony and he put it into the ark and attached the poles to the ark and put the mercy seat on top of the ark. So what's inside the ark at this moment when he puts the mercy seat on it?
Just the stone tablets.
Just the stone tablets. Which stone tablets?
The second set.
The second set, because the first set were broken. Anybody here who's ever watched Raiders of the Lost Ark?
They were all crumbly.
He said that it was the first set of stones. And then, of course, when they opened them, they were all crumbly, yeah. So he said that it was the fragments of the broken stones that were put inside here. Go back and watch the movie. They got that one completely wrong. And you would think with a name like Spielberg, you know, you'd think you'd get that right. You had your hand up?
Okay, the mercy seat is the cover, the
Capereth, the covering, yes.
The anointment.
Yeah, the anointment cover thing is the technical term. And
okay,
yes,
that's what it is.
It is the solid gold covering that is the lid to the box.
Okay.
And it has the angels on top of it. We are at verse
18.
20.
Oh, sorry.
Then he took the testimony. I'm not listening to you, woman. And you have to wag your finger like that when you say it. Verse 20, then he took the testimony and put it into the ark and attached the poles to the ark and put the mercy seat on top of the ark. And he brought the ark into the tabernacle and set up a veil for the screen and screened off the ark of the testimony, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Then he put the table in the tent of meeting on the north side of the tabernacle outside the veil. And he set the arrangement of bread in order on it before the Lord, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And he placed the lampstand in the tent of meeting opposite the table on the south side of the tabernacle. And he lighted the lamps before the Lord, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Then he placed the gold altar in the tent of meeting in front of the veil. And he burned fragrant incense on it, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And he set up the veil for the doorway of the tabernacle. And he set the altar of burnt offering before the doorway of the tabernacle of the tent of meeting, and offered on it the burnt offering and the meal offering, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And he placed the laver between the tent of meeting and the altar, and had water in it for washing. And from it, Moses and Aaron and his sons washed their hands and their feet. When they entered the tent of meeting, and when they approached the altar, they washed, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. And he erected the court all around the tabernacle and the altar, and hung up the veil for the gateway of the court. Thus Moses finished the work. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Consistent personality profile of God. He had the people of Israel make all this furniture. Then he consecrated all of it and said, "This isn't for you anymore. This is for me. Only Aaron and his sons can even come in here because I choose them." Then he says to Moses, "Moses, you have to go in and set it up." So Moses goes in and sets everything up the way that he's been told to set it up, and then he consecrates it to God. And then when God's presence arrives, nobody can be in there when the presence of God is in there, because God is not like people and people are not like God. And when the presence of a holy God shows up, even Moses would be a dead man if he went in there. So humans did everything God said to do, and humans set it up, and humans consecrated it, and humans lit the incense and poured the oil, and they're going to sacrifice the animals. And all of those efforts still weren't good enough to consecrate God's place where God would talk with his people. And so God himself comes and consecrates it. And when he does, everybody out. It's going to happen again when Solomon's temple is finally erected. God's going to do it again. He's going to cleanse the temple. And when he does, nobody gets to go in, because as I keep on saying, you're not God, God's not you, and he's not like you. Therefore, he can say to you, this is mine, don't touch it, and when I'm here, you can't be, because I'm holy and you're not. And that is our primary problem. Our primary problem as sinful human beings is that we are dealing with this very God, who even on planet Earth, in a tent, in the desert, over there in the Middle East, when the presence of God showed up, no humans got to be there. How much less is any human going to be able to burst into the presence of God when he's on his throne in his heavenly majesty, surrounded with his angels, yelling back and forth, "Holy, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God." When his own angels are declaring his holiness, when the stars and the planets flee from his sight, when he has the four living creatures in front of him and he is in his absolute splendor, humans think they're going to walk into that and plead their case and say, "Let me tell you what I did. Let me tell you how good I am. Let me tell you about my works. Let me tell you what a good person I was." Even if it's a tent in the Middle East, 3,400 years ago, God says, when my presence shows up, nobody comes in. Even Moses, who we spoke to like a friend, had to get out. Yes?
Only those specifically elected by God are allowed in his presence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He chose Moses and Aaron and his sons to serve in the tabernacle, and he chose them. He elected them.
You're
yeah.
Right, but you tell me the first of this verse. We shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is.
There's the answer. When Christ returns, we will be like him and we'll see him as he is. I think the whole point of that is the instantaneous change. This mortal puts on immortality. This corruptible puts on incorruptibility. See, we're not going to go into his presence like this. First, we have to have holiness put on us, and that is the point of imputation, that our sinfulness was placed on Christ and punished, so that we will be imputed with the righteousness of God, so that we can stand in front of God, perfect, undefiled, unblemished, and perfected forever. That is the whole point of the Christian gospel.
We shall be like him.
We'll be like him. Hmm. And I'm tired of being like me,
yeah.
So I'm looking forward to being like him. Isn't that hard to fathom? But it's the whole point of the Christian gospel, as I've said, because this God, who we see consistently throughout the Bible, says, I'm holy, 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 and therefore I am so holy, human beings cannot come into my presence. When Moses said, show me your glory, God said, oh, you don't even know what you're asking. No, I'll kill you. You'll get to see the last trail of it. That's going to make your face glow. You couldn't stand here and see God in his glory. The higher your understanding and estimation of God in his righteous holiness, the more you see the absolute necessity of an intercessor. I grew up not really understanding the Jesus thing. I grew up in the Lutheran church where it was God, God, worship God, come here, God, sort of God. But even then, the view of God was quite low because you could tell God what to do and all that kind of stuff. And then pray, and I would say, pray to who? Pray to God? Pray to Jesus? Do I pray to the Holy Spirit? How do I pray? What do I pray to whom? And Jesus seemed like a take-it-or-leave-it addition to my church life. I never understood the necessity of him because God was presented with such a low, low view that it always seemed like God liked me because he likes everybody. He must love me because he loves everybody. And he likes and loves me so much that I'll live how I live, and when I die, he'll be good to me because he likes me that much, he loves me that much. And there was never any sense that we were standing in the presence of an absolutely righteous, holy God whose holiness demanded justice. I never heard that. And once I came to grips with it, which is what this whole Old Testament representation of God is about, to make sure you understand what God you're dealing with. You're dealing with a God who could take 5 million people, plant them at the foot of a mountain for a year, and say, now here are my commands, here's what I expect from you, bring the gold and silver, build me a place, and when you build it, it's mine, and don't you ever go in there again. And in fact, I'll even cover it in such a way that from the outside, it looks quite normal. But on the inside, where I am and where the priests are, it's going to be full of gold and bronze and silver and fine twined linen and beauty and embroidery. And that's the kind of God you're dealing with who says, when my holiness is present, no one gets to stand in front of me. And that's the God you're dealing with. So my point is, and I hope you leave here tonight getting this clear in your head, even if you don't understand the details of every socket and every peg of the tabernacle, what the tabernacle says, what it broadcasts loud and clear is, God is absolutely holy, and he says how you approach him, and he says when you approach him, and he says what the prerequisites are for approaching him. And the punishment for approaching him wrong is death because he's that holy a God. And yet, that very same God provided a way that wretches like me can know that when I leave this planet and am ushered into the presence of that God, I will be accepted as he's in his majesty and his splendor and the wonder of God. I will be accepted in that court because somebody else, my intercessor, my high priest, fully accomplished the atonement that satisfied God's wrath and judgment and perfected me. That's the point of Christ. And so that ought to raise your estimation of Christ to however high your estimation of God's holiness is. Your estimation of God's holiness ought to be infinitely high, and your estimation of the necessity of Christ needs to be right up there with it. Because without him, you got nothing when you stand in front of that God. The cloud covered the tent of meeting. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, and Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because of the cloud that had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And throughout all their journeys, whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the sons of Israel would set out. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out until the day that it was taken up. So this pillar of cloud is established over the tabernacle where God is. And when the cloud moved up, they knew it was time to pack up their tents. We're moving again. And when the cloud would settle, they'd set up the tent and they'd settle there. So God is present and he's leading them and he's obvious. And they rebel. And they argue and they complain. And they are wretched. What this ought to tell you, again, same consistent theology over and over, is left to themselves, despite the amount of evidence they may have, human beings simply will not, because they cannot, be faithful to God, even if he's right there obvious. He came in a human tabernacle, walked on the planet, did miracles. Even the people who killed him knew of the miracles he did, knew that he was not just a regular, everyday, run-of-the-mill guy, but that he was something different. And they hated him for it. And they killed him for it. Because human beings, despite the amount of evidence you may give them, just don't get it. I spoke just before we came here to our friend from Zimbabwe. And we talked about the kids, and we talked about life. And when we got done, he said, "What I'm learning, what I understand now, is that life has to be about God. That every facet of life has to be about God." So what I emphasized to him was, because he said, you know, God is faithful. Even when we were at our worst, you know, God is faithful, and testifying to that. And then he said, "I'm having a conversation with these people who caused us so much trouble. And I'm trying to say to them, look, it's right here in the Bible. It's God, it's Jesus, that's your answer." And he said, "And they just won't hear it. What do I do, Pastor Jim?" And I said, "You pray and you pray and you pray, and then you be ready to give an answer." I said, "Because some people, you can give them all the evidence in the world, and they won't hear it because they can't hear it. Because that's how depraved human beings really are. And once you understand the evidence throughout the Bible of the human incapability and incapacity to comprehend the things of God, that will make you really, really thankful that you have any comprehension at all, because that is proof positive that God is drawing you. The real God, the holy God, is drawing you, enlightening you, has brought you up from your spiritual deadness, and he did it because he chose to. Out of all the people in the world, you were one of the people he revealed himself to. That is a wonderful, wonderful thing that you should never stop being aware of. And yet tomorrow we'll get busy driving and working and doing our thing, and we'll forget that the real God of forever is on our side. That ought to get you up every day feeling good, even if you get up feeling bad. You should get up and say, "This is a bad day, and I feel bad, and I feel, and the God of forever is on my side." So here, at the end of the book of Exodus, God's presence inhabits a tabernacle. And then Jesus walks on the planet. He tabernacled among us. So the Spirit of God was in the tabernacle of the flesh of Jesus Christ. And then Paul says that we, our bodies, are the temple, the tabernacle of the Lord, because the Holy Spirit of God now takes up residence in us. So we no longer need the tabernacle in the wilderness. We no longer need the tent of meeting where only the high priest can go. Jesus has once entered into the high holy place of God on our behalf. Therefore, we no longer need a temple or a tabernacle because we ourselves have the presence of God dwelling inside us.
And it's as real as that tabernacle.
So, the book of Exodus ends with, "For throughout all their journeys, the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and there was fire in it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel." Boy, that ought to convince them.
It ought to, because you haven't been out in the desert, and you know how hot it is, and you know how quick you get thirsty.
Now, by the way, what are those two symbols? Smoke and fire? Those are the same two symbols that delivered them out of Egypt. Those are the same two symbols that you find at the Abrahamic covenant. These are the same two symbols that God continually uses to say, "It's me, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I'm doing the delivering." It's in their presence. Everybody in Israel can see it day and night. Pillar of fire at night, pillar of cloud during the day, at the tabernacle, there he is. God is present. He's right here among us. I have never seen a manifestation, an undeniable manifestation of God in my life. I've never seen a person with no leg grow a leg. I've never seen a blind person come to sight. I've never spoken in tongues. I've never seen a physical manifestation where I could say, "Okay, there we go. That's what I've been waiting for. There it is. God just showed up and did something." 40 years these people have God in their presence, the pillar from the sky, fire at night, smoke by day, and yet, when they get to the end of the land, promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they're going to say, "Oh, we can't take that land. Oh, there's giants in that land. Oh, if we go in there, we'll get killed. Oh, there's no water. He brought us out here to die. Oh, there's no food. He brought us out here to die." He brings them right to the edge of it, sends in spies. The spies come back and say, "Yes, it's land of milk and honey. There's everything we could possibly need in there, but there's some people in there, and they were big people, so we can't take it." And despite all this evidence, God's going to march them around for 40 years till he strews their bones in the wilderness, and everybody over 20 who we just had numbered, who had the half shekel offering, are all going to die in the wilderness, and the second generation is going to go in, which speaks to the superiority of the second generation, as we've been seeing all the way through the Old Testament. But despite all that evidence, they couldn't believe, "I've never seen the physical manifestation evidence, and I believe." Why? Why did these people, after all that evidence, die in the wilderness in their unbelief? They should have believed, if anybody should have, and they didn't believe. "I've never seen, and I believe, and I've devoted my life to this thing. And standing up here week in and week out and putting it out on the internet and telling people, I believe, I'm a believer, I'm one of those guys, I'm one of those Christian people, I'm one of those nutty people who has committed themselves to the truth of this thing, and I've never seen physical evidence and proof outside of the one proof I can't escape, which is the one proof that Jesus said would be the only sign he would give. I am absolutely captured by the resurrection. And if Christ came up out of the grave, he's everything he said he was, and his spirit abides in me, lives in me, making me the tabernacle of the Lord, and I believe the evidence. And that is just grace, 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 grace.
Yeah. Blessed are those who have not seen.
And yet believe, and yet believe. I'm one of those guys. Because Israel saw and saw and saw and saw and didn't believe. It's better to not necessarily see all that and believe. Because I'm going to see the splendor of forever and be accepted when I get there. That's the Christian message. You got it?
Yep. They just kind of wanted God right now.
Oh, yeah, they wanted everything right now. We want quail right now.
And they didn't believe in it. You know, future blessing of the goodness of God.
That's right.
I believe that's the reason Abraham was saved.
He believed the promise. There was a promise given him, and he believed the promise. And that's the difference. These people just wouldn't believe. So, we have successfully finished the book of Exodus then. Well, Shane, what was that look? What was that look?
Surprise.
Total and complete surprise that we successfully did it? You are now off on Wednesday nights until the beginning of January. I'll have to look at a calendar and I will tell you which Wednesday in January will begin. Somewhere in that first full week of January, we'll be back here on Wednesdays, and we will start our survey of the book of Leviticus. So get your Christmas shopping done. Don't get me anything big. No, go ahead, get me something big. And you've got your Wednesdays off. Are there any questions about all that?
I have a comment.
Yes.
I would have thought it would be so nerve-wracking to be Moses trying to set up this
happening. Yes.
And I see how God chooses some people to take these tremendous risks on behalf of other people. Mm-hmm. You know, and I just think we should remember to pray for those people that are sort of standing in the gap for us.
One of the things that, I guess I've said this enough times, but I'll say it again. Nowhere in the Bible do you find anybody put in a leadership position who wanted the job. Nowhere. Which is why I get nervous when I find somebody who wants the job. When you see somebody too gung-ho to go lead people, that's within a Christian context, that's worrisome to me. Because God always picks people who struggle with the fact that they've been given the job. But look what Paul went through for the job. Look what Moses went through for the job. Paul was not. And they're always whiny.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.